Our program today is on ultra-rapid-acting insulin, and we have a very good speaker, Lori Loeffel, who is the Chief of Pediatrics and Adolescent and Young Adult Section and the Senior Investigator of that section on Behavioral and Outcomes Research, Professor of Pediatrics at the Joslin Diabetes Center at Harvard Medical School in Boston. So what we're going to do now is I will go through some of the older insulins, and then Lori will talk about these ultra-rapid-acting mealtime insulins, why they are important, how they should be used, provide patients with flexibility in their lifestyle, their eating, and control their diabetes well. Let me start by a historical slide that I love to show, because this is about the discovery of insulin. Prior to 1920, children with type 1 diabetes died within a few months. And Dr. Banting was a surgeon. He wasn't doing very well as a surgeon. It's a great story. He wasn't doing well as a surgeon. And at that time, the theory was that diabetes was a disease of the kidney. Dr. Banting read an article by a Romanian doctor who said, no, it's maybe the pancreas that's the problem. And he wanted to do some studies on this. The surgeons wouldn't let him do it, so he came to the Department of Medicine, joined the Department of Medicine, and then started experimenting on drug dogs, took out the pancreas. They got type 1 diabetes, like symptoms, and he made an extract of the pancreas and injected it back. And he had a medical student, so medical students here, take note, the medical student woke up Dr. Banting, who was asleep in the lab one day, and said, you know, that dog, who was almost dying, he's running around the lab now. I can't even catch him. And they were very excited. The next morning, the University of Toronto issued a press release that they had found a cure for diabetes. And within a few months, Dr. Banting got the Nobel Prize in medicine. And he objected first. He said it was, we need to do on our best as well, and they wouldn't do it. But he shared his prize money with the medical students. So since then, we've learned a lot about insulin. That was regular insulin, and extracted from animal pancreases. People were still taking the insulin. They had to take it every 4 to 6 hours. Did not do well on it. They were getting complications of diabetes. But we learned from landmark trials like the DCCT that you could reduce this risk of complications by good control, and that this benefit lasted for a long, long time. So we have people now with type 1 diabetes who are controlled, living on to a very good age, and this has really transformed how we manage people. And we've also done similar studies in type 2 called the UKPDS, and now there are many, many more. The VA did a long-term study, and it suggested that if you control diabetes early, you get what is called a legacy effect. That's very important. You have this, if you wait too long, you have this bad legacy of complications that have developed and are irreversible. So we need to do everything we can to treat type 1 diabetes very well, and maybe even type 2. And that's very challenging in young people. And so this, what we're talking about today is very important. So let's turn back to physiology. Insulin is secreted in a small amount all the time, what we call basal insulin. And then in response to a meal, within a few minutes, you get a rapid rise in insulin levels that then declines as you bring the blood glucose down. And this is repeated every time you eat. So this is a meal-related spike in insulin secretion, 5- to 10-fold increase in insulin levels. And some of this occurs almost immediately in response with stored insulin. It's called the first phase of insulin release. Comes down a bit, and then the pancreas, the beta cell, makes more insulin and releases it in what is called the second phase. You could give insulin subcutaneously and mimic the second phase. It's very hard to replicate this first phase. We also need basal insulin. So with this came the concept of giving basal insulin. We used to use NPH at night, and it didn't work very well. And now we have other long-acting insulins. And then we give these mealtime, to mimic this mealtime response, we give bolus insulin or prandial insulin. So it takes you to give 3-4 injections a day, sometimes more, or use an insulin pump. One of the problems with this insulin delivery, traditional insulins, is that you get a lot of hypoglycemia. And the better your control, the higher your risk of hypoglycemia. You see here at an A1C of 7%, you get a very sharp increase. This was in the DCCT trial. So rather than making people completely normal, they had to stop at an A1C of 7%. That was a major limitation in managing diabetes. And this was seen in type 2 as well in insulin-treated patients, although the rate of hypoglycemia was less in type 2. Insulin pumps try to mimic this physiology a little bit better. They don't rely so much on insulin absorption. They use a short-acting insulin delivered on a continuous basis, and you can press a button to give a bolus whenever you eat or the blood sugar is high. And you can try, our aim is to keep the blood glucose as normal as possible. When continuous glucose monitoring became available, we realized that there were many times during the day when people were spiking high or dropping low that we had not been aware of. This also was a problem that we couldn't really address very well. Today, the standard of care is to use continuous glucose monitoring with either multiple injections or a pump. And if you use it with a pump, you have these closed loop systems where the glucose monitor controls the pump and adjusts it, predicts what's going to happen with the glucose and adjusts the pump infusion rate. There are still problems. Insulin absorption is very erratic. As I'll show you, it depends on the type of insulin, the volume you give, where you give it, the depth of injection, regional blood flow that is dependent on exercise or the skin temperature, the ambient temperature, whether it's summer or winter, all this makes a difference. So people get blood sugars that fluctuate a lot. Plus, that was regular insulin, which, as I'll show you, had some problems. But we started understanding insulin molecular structure much better. So there's the A chain, B chain, connected by connecting peptide, C-peptide, which is cleaved off from proinsulin. And you have these two chains bound together by these bonds. Small changes can be made in the lab to insulin. So here, lysine and proline are interchanged to form lysoproinsulin, which was the first synthetic insulin. And then another one, aspart was substituted for proline to give you aspart insulin. So what does that do? Well, human insulin is, it tends to self-aggregate. The molecules form, six molecules stick together, and it takes 30 to 60 minutes to break down and then get absorbed. It's not absorbed as this hexagon. So we have to tell people, take your insulin, wait 30 to 60 minutes before you start eating. That's very, very challenging for anybody, leave aside a young child who's hungry. And with these analog of insulins, with these small substitutions, you could decrease this hexagon formation so it dissociates quicker. So here's the difference. This is regular insulin taking a long time, not mimicking first phase insulin. And here's lispro and aspart. And these have become, in the last 20 years, the standard insulins that we use for parenteral insulin injection. And the same happened at the other end, at glargine. Was also similarly modified, so it was longer acting than NPH. And we started noticing, this is from some work that we were involved here at Tulane in doing, showing that as your A1C drops, your hypoglycemia rate goes up, but it's different between the insulins. It's less with glargine for the same level of A1C than when you compare it with NPH. And the same with these rapid-acting insulins, less hypoglycemia with lispro as compared to regular insulin. So more frequent hypoglycemia with what we thought was good, traditional human insulin, and better, less hypoglycemia and better control with these analogs. So here is and Lori will go into this in more detail. Here's the pharmacokinetics of regular insulin. Ultra-rapid insulin is even faster than rapid-acting insulin. It's still not quite the same as what normal physiology is, and that's very important. So here are the formulations. She'll go into that more. There are other tools that we try to use to make people's lives better, using insulin pens, using pumps when we can. And then about 20 years ago, there was a lot of pressure to make a non-injectable insulin. All the orals failed, but the lung is there's just one in the alveolus, one cell separating the alveolus from the air. So if you could get insulin there, you could get it absorbed very quickly. And this was tested out. We were involved with all these trials with a device that was not very small, but still delivered insulin to the lung, and from where it was rapidly absorbed. Lori will go into more details on this, but we need to tailor insulin therapy to match the patient's goals and their lifestyles. And there are many barriers to that. Clinicians need to know more about this. The patients need the support that they need, including psychological support. And the treatment, the cost, the complexity, and using the right kind of insulin is very important. So there are a lot of choices that patients have to make to control their diabetes well. Beforehand, I want to mention that insulin is just one hormone. We think of it as the hormone of diabetes, but today it's become a complex multi-hormone disorder that we recognize. And we're replacing it. We're involved with trials using other adjuncts to insulin, including GLP-1, SGLT2 inhibitors, and so on.